Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Ann Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, at sundown in Nigeria, children are playing a game called Igalagala. The children play near their home. As they play, their mother looks sad. Their two older brothers, Abuna and Dunama, are missing. They were arrested in 2013 by Nigerian soldiers. The woman asked to be called Bintu because she fears being harmed by Nigerian security agents. She told VOA, "One night, soldiers came around 3 a.m., hitting our door and asking, 'Where are the boys? Where are the boys? Bring out your sons.'" Bintu says soldiers had gone throughout the neighborhood that night, arresting teenage boys. She and the other mothers whose sons were taken followed the soldiers' vehicle. She said, "They took them to a place and they told the children to lie face down in the ground and they were beating them." Abuna and Dunama were high school students when they were arrested. Bintu's story is not unusual. Amnesty International has documented thousands of cases of what it calls forced disappearances. That is the term it uses for people held in secret detention centers without facing charges or being put on trial. The Nigerian military has repeatedly denied cases of forced disappearance. It began trials last year of more than 2,300 suspected Boko Haram militants. But those trials have been kept in secret. Recently, Human Rights Watch raised concern about the fairness of the trials. Hamsatu Alaman, a local activist, decided to find a way to give a voice to the women who have been separated from their sons and husbands. She decided to create a kind of network or organization, one for wives and the other for mothers. More than 1,300 people are now active with Alaman's group. Most live in camps for people displaced within the country. Alaman's goal is to get Nigerian officials to tell these women where their loved ones are, so she has equipped them with tools to speak out. Last year, Alaman helped the women release a campaign video that was shared on social media. In the video, some of the women explain how their husbands or sons were arrested. Earlier this year, the women wrote an open letter to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. They asked for him to help with the cases of 1,269 detained loved ones. But Justice Wakil Akali Gana said the detainees may not be as innocent as the women say they are. He told VOA, "People will always say that they're innocent, that their rights are being abused. When you go through it, you'll see. They have reasons to be brought here." The judge works at the High Court in Maiduguri, where hundreds of Boko Haram-related cases have been tried. One day, something surprising happened at one of the largest camps in the Maiduguri area. A young man in his early 20s walked up to a woman sitting in the entrance to a shelter. As soon as she saw him, she recognized he was her son. The man told her that he had been released from a nearby military camp. Years ago, he and his father were arrested because Nigerian officials thought they were Boko Haram members. The young man said he was released, but his father is still in detention. The woman, who wants to be called Bintu, still has important documents belonging to her sons Abuna and Dunama. There are birth records, old homework and report cards from school, and health records. A few years ago, someone told her that her boys were dead. But with these documents, she will keep them alive, waiting for the government to tell her where they are.
It is common to see many different kinds of insects while spending time outside in the summer. Some of these tiny creatures do not bother people and can even add beauty to the natural environment. Examples of these are insects like ladybugs, butterflies, and fireflies. Other insects can harm the environment or humans. Many are known to bite or sting. Some carry dangerous diseases. This group includes insects like mosquitoes, ticks, and cockroaches. The population of these insects seems to stay large and healthy. But scientists say this does not appear to be true for some flying insects that serve an important purpose. There is growing evidence that these insects are decreasing across the world. Many of these insects are very important to plant growth and development. They also serve as a necessary link in the food chain and can help break down life when animals die. One researcher looking into the current insect population is Doug Tolemy, a professor at the University of Delaware. He worries that a continual drop in the number of helpful insects could lead to disastrous results. If the insects disappeared, Earth's important life forms would begin to go away too, Tolemy told the Associated Press. This could result in a total breakdown of the ecosystem. How much worse can it get than that? He asked. Tolemy noted a statement by one of America's best-known biologists, E.O. Wilson, of Harvard University. Wilson once called insects the little things that run the world. Wilson is now 89 years old. He told the AP that he remembers walking through Washington, D.C. in the past when it was alive with insects, especially butterflies. Now, he said, the flying insects are virtually gone. Wilson said this point seemed to be confirmed during a drive he made last year from Boston, Massachusetts, to the neighboring state of Vermont. He was surprised that during his trip, he counted only one insect that had hit the car's front window. Several other scientists have carried out similar tests by checking how many insects hit their cars while traveling. An insect researcher from the University of Florida, Philip Kohler, reported that far fewer insects hit his vehicle today than in the past. While researchers admit this method is not scientific, they say it can still help them understand the changing insect population. Scientists say there are likely many reasons for the drop in flying insects. Most are related to the destruction of insect habitat caused by things like insecticides, other animals, pollution, and climate change. There have not been many studies done on the insect populations covering large areas. However, some international research suggests a downward turn. In 2006, a group of studies estimated there had been a 14% drop in ladybugs in the United States and Canada from 1987 to 2006. In Costa Rica, researchers have been studying the flying insect population at the La Selva Biological Station since 1991. One of the researchers is Lee Dyer from the University of Nevada at Reno. He told the AP his team has repeatedly examined a big trap that would have been covered with insects decades ago. Now they find no insects in the trap. In Germany, a 2017 study found an 82% drop in the number of flying insects captured in 63 traps across the country, compared to levels recorded in 1990. This is the main insect population study carried out so far. Researchers say it is difficult making similar comparisons in other areas. That is because similar insect counts were not done decades ago. After the German study, other countries also started looking into the problem. Tok Thomas Hoye of Aarhus University in Denmark studied flies in a few areas of rural Greenland. He said he discovered an 80% drop in the insects since 1996. David Wagner of the University of Connecticut says other evidence leads him to believe the findings of the 2017 study are clearly not a German thing. Wagner has measured drops in moth populations in the northeastern United States. We just have to find out how widespread the phenomenon is, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Two small Japanese robots landed on a distant asteroid last weekend. The robots took small jumps, making it the first time that any device from our planet has moved on the surface of an asteroid. The two machines, called rovers, landed on the asteroid Ryugu on September 21st. The Japanese Space Exploration Agency says they were lowered to the surface by an unmanned spacecraft called the Hayabusa 2. Asteroids are small rocky objects orbiting around the sun. They sometimes have been described as minor planets. The Japanese spacecraft first arrived at Ryugu last June. It flew as close as 55 meters to the asteroid before it released the rovers. Hayabusa 2 then rose back up to a waiting position about 20 kilometers above the surface. The next day, Japan's space agency, known as JAXA, released some pictures the rovers had sent back from the landing area. One shows the dark stone of Ryugu with a bright line of sunlight lighting up the asteroid's surface. "I cannot find words to express how happy I am," said JAXA project manager Yuichi Tsuda in a statement after the robots arrived. The rovers are named Minerva 2, 1A and 1B. They are about the size of a can used to hold cookies. Their movements are powered by solar energy from the sun. The low gravity levels on the asteroid make rolling difficult, so the rovers move by taking jumps up to 15 meters at a time. They will continue moving across the surface, taking pictures and collecting information about temperature. The Japanese Space Agency says they will keep jumping as long as their solar equipment and power last. A large rover and lander will be released onto the surface from Hayabusa 2 in the coming months. You may be wondering, why send a spacecraft millions of kilometers away to land on an ancient piece of rock traveling through space? Scientists believe that asteroids may provide information about the earliest days of our solar system, dating back some 4 billion years. Ryugu orbits the Sun between Earth and Mars and is a C-type asteroid, the most common type of asteroid in our solar system. Scientists believe some asteroids may contain organic matter and water. Ryugu may give researchers a window to see all the way back to the beginning of life itself. JAXA hopes to find out just what Ryugu is made up of by collecting materials from the asteroid's surface and bringing them home to be studied. Hayabusa 2 is set to try 3 brief landings on Ryugu to collect rock samples. The first attempt is expected to be in October. Later this week, the spacecraft is set to release another lander onto the asteroid. The device is a project of the German and French space agencies known as MASCOT. It will be carrying 4 observation devices. The spacecraft will release a larger rover called Minerva 2-2 in 2019. Hayabusa 2 will stay at Ryugu until late next year. Then it will fly back to Earth with the asteroid samples. JAXA expects the spacecraft to return home by 2020. Scientists will study the samples to understand more about how planets were formed around the Sun in the early days of our solar system. In time, these samples will be compared to ones the American space agency, NASA, hopes to get from the asteroid Bennu. NASA's spacecraft was launched 2 years ago. It is expected to reach Bennu in early December. NASA's spacecraft will then take samples from the asteroid in 2020. And 3 years later, they will return to Earth for scientists to study. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about William Henry Harrison. Although he was elected in 1840, many Americans still remember his catchy campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
For Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
Tyler referred to John Tyler, Harrison's partner on the ticket. In other words, Harrison was the candidate for president, and Tyler was the candidate for vice president. That seems straightforward enough, but Tippecanoe? That was Harrison's nickname. It came from a battle he had fought nearly 30 years before the presidential campaign. At that time, Harrison led troops against an alliance of Native American tribes. The alliance was fighting white American settlers who were taking Native people's territory. Harrison and his men wanted to prevent the alliance from getting the supplies and warriors it needed to fight a long war. They planned to attack an important Native American base in what is today the state of Indiana. But Native American warriors attacked first. They struck at dawn, when Harrison's men were still sleeping in a camp near the river Tippecanoe. The battle was confused and bloody. Many fighters on both sides died. It was not really clear who won, but Harrison declared victory. His presidential campaign reminded voters about the battle. The nickname Tippecanoe suggested Harrison was a simple yet tough Westerner who would fight for white Americans. But that image of Harrison was not entirely true. Harrison did not come from a simple Western family. Instead, he was the youngest child of a wealthy family from the southern state of Virginia. The Harrisons were active in the politics of the young nation. His father signed the Declaration of Independence and became the governor of Virginia. Young William Harrison received a good education, but he did not want to become a doctor or lawyer. He joined the military instead. Harrison succeeded quickly as an army officer. He earned a reputation as an able leader in fights against Native Americans. Harrison became the governor of what was known as Indiana Territory. In that job, he persuaded Native Americans to enter into treaties that sold their land to the U.S. government, often for very little money. Harrison's insistence on securing land for white settlers was one reason Native American tribes formed an alliance against the United States. A member of the Shawnee tribe, Tecumseh, was one of their most prominent leaders. It was Tecumseh's men who fought against Harrison in the Battle of Tippecanoe. Tecumseh's men clashed again with Harrison during the War of 1812 at a battle in Ontario, Canada, near the River Thames. In that battle, both the British and Native Americans were clearly defeated. Tecumseh was killed. After that, the Native American alliance fell apart, and Harrison became famous again. Although Harrison was a well-known fighter against Native Americans, he could not find lasting success as a politician. He served briefly in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, but he did not stay in those positions long. He struggled with debt. His home in Indiana was very expensive. He also had to provide for his 10 children. The emotional cost of his family was also high. Only 4 of his children lived past the age of 40. In 1836, Harrison's fortunes seemed to change. A new party, called the Whigs, looked to him as a presidential candidate. The Whigs strongly opposed President Andrew Jackson and his policies. They did not want Jackson's vice president and right-hand man, Martin Van Buren, to become president. But they understood that Jackson was very popular with everyday Americans. So the Whigs thought that Harrison, a military hero from the West, just as Jackson was, would appeal to voters. At the time, voting was limited mostly to white men. The Whigs nominated Harrison as one of their candidates. Harrison did well, but not well enough. Van Buren won the 1836 election, but the next election belonged to Harrison. His campaign developed that memorable song about Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. Supporters also turned an insult against Harrison into an advantage. Harrison's opposition said he would be happy to spend the rest of his life just sitting in a log cabin and drinking hard cider, an alcoholic drink made from apples. The opposition wanted to suggest that Harrison was not really interested in becoming president and working hard for the American people. But Harrison's supporters used the images of a log cabin and hard cider to portray Harrison as a humble man who could relate to common Americans. The plan was a success. Harrison won the election.
Sure, let him talk about hard cider, 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 and log cabins too. Will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with him we'll beat little Van, Van, Van is a used up man. And with him we'll beat little Van.
At 68, Harrison was the oldest person yet to take office. On his inauguration day, he reportedly wanted to show that he was strong enough to serve as president by delivering a very long speech without wearing a coat or hat. Several weeks later, Harrison became sick. He complained of many problems, anxiety, fatigue, and pain in his stomach. His health grew worse and worse. 1 month after he was sworn in, Harrison died. It was the first time in the country's history that a president had died in office. The event raised many questions about who would become president. That question is answered in the next episode of this series. For future generations, it also raised a question about what Harrison died of. The traditional story is that his long inaugural speech led to a fatal pneumonia. But researchers in 2014 proposed a different reason. Jane McHugh and Philip Makowiak wrote in the New York Times that while Harrison was in office, Washington, D.C. did not have a good sewer system. Human waste simply flowed onto public grounds a short distance from the White House. The researchers conclude that Harrison probably died from problems related to drinking dirty water in the president's house. So, for Harrison, winning the White House may not have been good fortune at all.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.